the ability to see better what was going on here in terms of warning signs, there would have been very different action taken, in my view. There's no way that that student would have been returned to the classroom. So even when you go beyond the disturbing questions of his access as a 15-year-old to a handgun, there's also the question of why was the situation so ignored in some ways.
And we're going to talk more about that in the second part of our conversation. Mark Fulman, author of the new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America, national affairs editor at Mother Jones, where he covers gun violence and runs their mass shootings database, which we're going to talk about. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a news writer producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply immediately. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month. And KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, more abortion services will be needed in Eastern Oregon. A Eugene Starbucks is the first to unionize in the state. And April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. We'll hear more about warning signs. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 15th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Planned Parenthood is renting medical space in the town of Ontario on the Oregon-Idaho border. The organization has not confirmed its plans for the space, but it has said it's preparing for an influx of out-of-state patients seeking abortions in Oregon in light of recent legal and legislative challenges to abortion access. A clinic in Ontario could be a significant outpost for access to abortion and other reproductive health care services. That's especially critical in advance of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that is anticipated this summer. Many believe the decision will overturn Roe v. Wade, the nearly 50-year-old landmark national abortion ruling. Idaho has two laws criminalizing abortion at all stages of pregnancy. They would take effect in the event of a successful legal challenge to Roe. In addition, Idaho passed a law, modeled after legislation in Texas, that would ban all abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. It would also allow family members to sue abortion providers. The Idaho law was set to take effect on April 22nd, but the Idaho Supreme Court issued a stay while it hears a legal challenge filed by the Planned Parenthood affiliate in Idaho. Oregon has no legal restrictions on abortion, but the state has just one clinic that performs the procedure east of the Cascade Mountains, in Bend. For those seeking abortions in eastern and northeastern parts of the state, the closest clinics are out of state, in Boise or Walla Walla, Washington. In 2020, 1,680 people received abortions in Idaho, according to data from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. The overwhelming majority were Idaho residents and took place in Ada County, where Boise is located. Economists have reported that even a modest increase, up to 100 miles, in the distance a pregnant person has to travel to get an abortion, leads to a significant decline in the number of abortions and an increase in the birth rate. Kenji Nozaki, chief of affiliate operations at Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette, said, quote, "No matter what happens, we will be there for our in-state and out-of-state neighbors and continue to meet the needs of our patients. We are prepared to support anyone who seeks their legal right to decide whether and when to become pregnant," end quote. A Florida abortion fund is among those raising awareness about anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers. Advocates say they use deceptive tactics to discourage people from seeking abortions, yet they also receive state, local, and philanthropic funding. Lily Bolke has more.
Florida reproductive health advocates are urging people to be aware of anti-abortion groups known as crisis pregnancy centers. They offer pregnancy tests and counseling to discourage abortions and sometimes other resources such as diapers. The Florida legislature recently banned abortions after 15 weeks, and this week, a judge deemed the 24-hour waiting period for an abortion constitutional. Lisa Kovacs with the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund says it's important to have accurate information about the full range of options, including parenting, adoption, or abortion, but these centers often use deceptive tactics to appear to be regular reproductive care providers.
It's a serious issue that they're growing while there's just more restrictions to access to abortion. The 15-week ban just passed. There's now the 24-hour wait period.
Florida has the second highest number of crisis pregnancy centers in the nation with 150. Texas is the only state with more, compared to 65 abortion clinics. The Florida legislature has allocated at least $30 million to the Florida Pregnancy Care Network, which supports CPCs, since 2009. And centers have gotten roughly $68 million in foundation funding in recent years. Before moving to Florida, Kovacs was a volunteer with NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. There, she went to a crisis pregnancy center to learn what the experience is like, what's known as secret shopping. She says another member who was pregnant donated urine so she could see what they would say to someone who's pregnant.
While we waited for the results on a dollar store pregnancy test, which was about an hour, I was told all the ways that an abortion would give me depression, would be a terrible mistake.
Kovacs adds the staff at that CPC shared various other misconceptions and called her multiple times afterward to check in. She says her experience reinforced the need to find care that's based in science. She points to the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund's website for a list of abortion clinics and other resources. She also recommends Plan C, where researchers have vetted many online pharmacies selling abortion pills, testing them for quality and the time they take to arrive, and posting that data on the Plan C website. This is Lily Bolke with Florida News Connection.
Workers in Eugene, Oregon, are the first Starbucks employees in the state to unionize. The union was unanimously approved by the South Eugene Starbucks on Wednesday. This is the latest in a nationwide push to unionize the coffee shop chain. Three other Starbucks across the nation voted to unionize in the last several days. According to the nonprofit More Perfect Union, seven more Starbucks in Eugene have filed for a union election. These locations are amongst 180 Starbucks nationwide, with union votes scheduled in upcoming months. Jake Lamori is a barista who helped organize the push to unionize. Lamori says the vote is just the beginning and anticipates negotiations to take a year or longer. April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. Mental health experts say adults should be more mindful of the stress kids have endured during the pandemic. And those involved with abuse prevention say some of the red flags are similar and not as obvious as physical trauma. Mike Moen has more on the story in South Dakota.
In an era of heightened mental health awareness, authorities and youth advocates in South Dakota say it's also key not to lose sight of signs of child abuse. Experts say some crisis signals cross paths. April is recognized in the U.S. as Child Abuse Prevention Month. Wendy Klopner is state's attorney for South Dakota's Lake County. She says educators help by serving as mandatory reporters when they see bruises or other unexplained marks. During the pandemic, schools also have expressed more mental health needs for students, citing changes in behavior. Lopner says those also can be symptoms of abuse.
Children who have mood changes or behavior disruptions, that would be something that we would look for and we would maybe want to inquire with the child. about what is happening at home.
Klopner, also a board member with the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, says law enforcement looks for some of the same signs in cases tied to trauma. The center is encouraging South Dakotans to spread awareness this month by signing up to be a Blue Ambassador. Enrollees can receive content to share within community and social media networks. At the onset of the pandemic, the American Academy of Pediatrics urged parents to practice self-care and not let COVID stress manifest into child abuse, including verbal attacks. Klopner says situations that involve actions like excessive screaming are something law enforcement can follow up on.
If a report comes to my office, for example, that a child is continuously emotionally abused, that could turn into what we call an abuse and neglect case, where we ask the Department of Social Services to step in and monitor the family.
And like other cases involving suspected abuse, social services can determine if a child should be removed from the home. Klopner hopes this month's awareness creates more places for kids to feel safe and talk with adults if they're experiencing trauma. Beyond school, she says that can include after-school activities such as sports. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
Portland police collected indiscriminate data and surveillance of people who participated in the 2020 racial justice protests, even when they weren't suspected of a crime. That's according to an audit of the Portland Police Bureau's tactics and internal practices that was released last week. The Portland police used at least 37 types of surveillance technology, including room x-rays, but only half have internal policies that tell cops how they can use them. Here's what the American Civil Liberties Union wrote of the audit. Quote, "Such indiscriminate, warrantless surveillance chills free speech, erodes trust between community and government, and creates alarming opportunities for abuse. That is why, under Oregon law, the police are prohibited from collecting and maintaining information on anyone's political views or activities outside of a criminal investigation." PPB's broad and highly intrusive surveillance of protesters in 2020 is a blatant violation of this law. End quote. KBOO's Althea Billings spoke with ACLU of Oregon staff attorney Rachel Dalal Gale to learn more about the impacts of this new information.
So the PPB audit, how does it relate to work that the ACLU of Oregon has already done in relation to surveillance by the PPB?
Yeah, so this really just confirms a lot of what we already suspected and feared about PPB's surveillance capabilities. We've already successfully sued PPB over its live streaming surveillance of the 2020 protests. So we knew that to some extent this was happening. We didn't realize, however, the extent of it. And the audit report really dives deeper into the world of surveillance at PPB and reveals that this is a much more systemic issue than we had feared. So for instance, the audit report stated that PPB has 37 different surveillance technologies at its disposal. It unfortunately doesn't identify those for the public, but that feeds into our work in that now we know that that exists, and that's an area that we pursue in the future in terms of requesting records and making those available for the public so that we can have increased transparency and accountability on this issue.
To your mind and in your experience, what should the PPB be doing to not violate the First Amendment protections of protesters? I know that's kind of an esoteric question, but this audit shows how, you know, freewheeling they are.
Right. So I think the audit really zeroes in on one of the main solutions here, and that is just increased internal accountability within PPB. So the audit identifies that there are pretty much no procedural guardrails in place to govern the use of these surveillance technologies or surveillance strategies. And that in itself is a problem, because then it's down to individual officers on the ground making decisions in the moment without any guidance about whether and how to surveil protesters or anyone else, when really there should be guidance coming from the top, from management, in an informed way that takes into account our civil liberties and our legal protections that dictate when it is and isn't appropriate to use these technologies. And ideally that information would be public, it would be transparent, we would be able to hold people accountable to it. There would be input from attorneys who are aware of the law and able to counsel PPB about what is and isn't appropriate. So there's a whole system that I think should exist around these issues that simply doesn't. And that's going to be a huge step, is making sure that that is eventually implemented.
Are there grounds for individuals who were surveilled or who think that they may have been surveilled to sue the PPB or to find that out for sure?
Yeah, so the first step, and one that we're really encouraging people to take, is to reach out to the city and request records. So if you were at the 2020 protests and you think that you might have been subject to this illegal surveillance, ask Portland and find out. See if they have any records about you. And if you find anything, reach out to ACLU. We have an intake form on our website. We would love to hear from you because there are steps you can take at that point.
That was ACLU Oregon staff attorney Rachel Dalal-Gale speaking with KBOO's Althea Billings about the recent audit of the Portland Police Bureau that showed the indiscriminate surveillance tactics they used in the 2020 protests. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines, produced by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 2012, the first World Art Day was celebrated by the International Association of Art, promoting awareness of creative activity worldwide. The quote of the day is from physicist Albert Einstein, who said, "Art is standing with one hand extended into the universe and one hand extended into the world, and letting ourselves be a conduit for passing energy." Charged with the Brooklyn subway shooting was jailed without bail yesterday. Authorities say Frank James, 62, released smoke bombs and shot dozens of bullets in a morning commuter train. He is charged with a federal terrorism offense that applies to attacks on mass transit, but authorities say there is no evidence linking him to any terror organizations. No motive has been put forth. James was arrested in Manhattan after calling a police tip line to say where he was Wednesday, a day after the attack, which left 10 people with gunshot wounds. Assistant U.S. Attorney Sarah Winnick said, quote, "The defendant terrifyingly opened fire on passengers on a crowded subway train, interrupting their morning commute in a way the city hasn't seen in more than 20 years. The defendant's attack was premeditated, was carefully planned, and it caused terror among the victims and our entire city," end quote. Prosecutors said James wore a disguise, a construction worker-style hard hat and jacket that he took off right after the attack. His attorney, however, noted James alerted police to his whereabouts once he knew he was wanted. James' manhunt focused on downtown Manhattan after police got a tip from a high school junior who saw a man sitting on a bench with a duffel bag resting on a busy street near Chinatown. Jack Griffin, 17, snapped photos of James and sent them to the police. Eventually, police got 911 reports of other possible sightings, and they also got a call from James, saying he was at a McDonald's in the East Village neighborhood. James was apprehended a few blocks from the McDonald's. James' lawyers agreed yesterday to his being jailed, but said they could seek bail later. His team requested psychiatric attention. In court papers, prosecutors suggested James had the means to carry out more attacks, noting that he had ammunition and other gun-related items in a Philadelphia storage unit. James posted hours of video on social media, as recently as Monday, in which he delivered profanity-laced speeches about racism, society's treatment of black people, houselessness, and violence. He also complained about how New York's mayor is dealing with houseless people in subways and with gun violence. He did talk about shooting people, prosecutors noted in court papers. His lawyers later asked the public not to prejudge him. The shooting victims, who range in age from 16 to 60, are all expected to survive. The head of the CIA says the Russian nuclear threat cannot be taken lightly, and President Biden calls for reduced reliance on foreign supply chains. With more on the stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Given the setbacks that they've faced so far militarily, none of us can take lightly the threat posed by a potential resort to tactical nuclear weapons or low-yield nuclear weapons.
Acknowledging fears of Russia using nuclear weapons in the Ukraine conflict, CIA Director William Burns said there's no evidence of Russia acting to do so. Ukraine, meanwhile, claims to have sunk a Russian warship, With its $750 million price tag, the loss of Moskva is the largest of the conflict so far. A week after Britain's prime minister pulled off a visit to Ukraine, President Joe Biden confirmed reports the U.S. is sending a top-level official.
We're making that decision now.
Also on Thursday, Biden again blamed the invasion for driving up food and gas prices.
Ukraine and Russia are the one and two largest wheat producers in the world. We're number three. They're shut down. We saw that in yesterday's inflation data.
Prices have risen 8.5% over the past 12 months. Biden called on Congress to pass a bill to help make the U.S. less dependent on foreign supply chains. And with the prime rate inching up, the interest rate for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage hit a 10-year high of 5%. Trade groups predict real estate sales to drop 10% this year. A new lawsuit, which aims to become a class action for shareholders, alleges Elon Musk delayed revealing his stake in Twitter in order to purchase shares at a lower price. Musk did not comment on the claim, but noted he's seeking free speech.
Twitter has become kind of the de facto town square. So it's just really important that people have both the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law.
The January 6th committee heard testimony from former Trump senior advisor Stephen Miller, who allegedly encouraged efforts to alter the outcome of the 2020 presidential election.
The election is over. That is the rule of law. That is our constitutional process. Those who refuse to accept the rulings of our courts are at war with the Constitution.
That's Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who supports criminal charges against former President Trump. Not all panel members appear in favor. The Republican National Committee voted to withdraw from the Commission on Presidential Debates, accusing the organization of bias. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a law banning most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy.
This will represent the most significant protections for life that have been enacted in this state in a generation.
The U.S. Supreme Court will soon rule on a similar ban in Mississippi. If approved, Florida's law could proceed, as well as a 15-week ban in Arizona. And a second bus of migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. arrived in Washington, D.C. from Texas. The group agreed to the journey as part of Republican Governor Greg Abbott's opposition to the end of Title 42 border expulsions. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
One day after Moscow suffered the loss of its flagship in the Black Sea Fleet, Russia's defense ministry promised to ramp up missile attacks on the Ukrainian capital. The guided missile cruiser Moskva, named for the Russian capital, sank while being towed to port yesterday. It suffered heavy damage from two Ukrainian missiles, according to the Pentagon. Moscow acknowledged a fire on board, but not any attack. The Moskva had the capacity to carry 16 long-range cruise missiles, other air defense missiles, and a variety of other guns. Maxim Marchenko is the governor of Ukraine's Black Sea region of Odessa. Marchenko said Ukrainian forces struck the Moskva with two Neptune missiles and caused serious damage. The Neptune is an anti-ship missile that was recently developed by Ukraine based on an earlier Soviet design. Its sinking reduces Russia's firepower in the Black Sea. If Ukrainian forces took out the vessel, the Moskva likely represents the largest warship to be sunk in combat since the Falklands War. The threat of intensified attacks on Kyiv came after Russian authorities accused Ukraine of wounding 7 people and damaging about 100 residential buildings with airstrikes on Bryansk, a region on the country's border. Russian troops have failed to capture Kyiv and are focusing on an assault in eastern Ukraine. In his nightly address yesterday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the people of his country should be proud of having survived 50 days under attack. He noted Russia had given them a maximum of 5. Zelensky did not mention the Moskva by name, but did say Russian warships sailed away, even if it's to the bottom of the sea. News about the flagship overshadowed Russian claims of advances in the southern port city of Mariupol, where Moscow's forces have been battling the Ukrainians since the early days of the invasion in some of the heaviest fighting of the war. Dwindling numbers of Ukrainian defenders in Mariupol are holding out against a siege that has trapped over 100,000 civilians in desperate need of food, water, and heat. Mariupol's mayor said this week that more than 10,000 civilians had died and the death toll could surpass 20,000. Mariupol's capture is critical for Russia because it would allow its forces in the south, which came up through the annexed Crimean Peninsula, to fully link up with troops in the Donbas region, Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland, and the target of an impending offensive. British defense officials said the Moskva's loss would likely force Moscow to change how its naval forces operate in the Black Sea. The UK Ministry of Defense said the ship, quote, served a key role as both a command vessel and air defense node, end quote. The 2020 census dramatically undercounted Native American populations, and it will mean less funding for tribes for the next 10 years. With that story and more, it's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The highest U.S. Census undercount of Native Americans in decades will result in fewer federal dollars for tribes and their citizens over the next 10 years. The Census Bureau estimates it missed a full 5% of Native Americans during the 2020 count. And as a comparison, the agency says it did come within 0.25% for the U.S. population as a whole. The agency could release a state-by-state breakdown of the undercount as early as next month. Roll Call reports Native Americans are typically undercounted, but the most recent census was also hindered by the pandemic. Critics also fault the Trump administration for creating confusion around the deadline to fill out the form and for unsuccessfully fighting to insert a citizenship question into the census. Several members of Congress are pushing the Bureau to address the undercount before the numbers are added to the funding formula. A White House report says Native Americans face persistent, unnecessary barriers to voting. The Interagency Steering Group on Native American Voting Rights released the report last month. It says indigenous people face language barriers, extreme physical distances to polling places, and lack of accessibility for voters with disabilities, among other issues. Recommendations in the report include passage of the Native American Voting Rights Act. In Southeast Alaska, tribal citizens who are experiencing addiction have access to a new, free online treatment, Claire Strempel reports.
It's called Culture Heals, and it's offered by the new mental health program at the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Dr. Tina Woods leads the council's community and behavioral health services team. She says the goal is to remove barriers for people seeking information or care.
Half the battle with behavioral health is being able to choose the right words to describe how you feel, to describe what you need. And Culture Heals Addiction is a platform that will allow people with resources all in one place to learn about something that they might be struggling with.
She says the Culture Heals tool addresses issues that underlie addiction, like generational or childhood trauma. William Andrews joined Dr. Woods' team last year and will lead men's healing groups. He says he got involved after therapy with the tribe helped him through the pandemic. He says that was the only therapy he could access because other local resources were unavailable.
I think this is one of the most important things that we're doing as far as like taking leadership in our community to help meet unmet needs that not just our citizens, but our community has.
Culture Heals is available online and is mobile friendly. It has links to information, culturally relevant videos, and an emergency hotline. Reporting for National Native News, I'm Claire Strempel.
In Maine, lawmakers cleared legislation that gives the Passamaquoddy tribe the ability to regulate its own drinking water. The Portland Press-Herald reports the bill faces a possible veto by the governor, Janet Mills. The bill would solve the tribe's concerns over current drinking water quality by allowing the tribe to drill wells on tribal land. The tribe could also work directly with federal officials instead of going through the state. Previous legislation limited the tribe's ability to act as a sovereign nation. That's something most tribes across the country take for granted. Opponents of the bill say it gives the tribe power to remove tribal land from the tax rolls without consent from local municipalities. With National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, April 15th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Caitlin Backus. Their producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bulkey, Shirley Jihad, Mike Bowen, Mark Richardson, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a longtime reporter at Philadelphia's WPVI-TV since the 1960s remembered in his early days spending shifts just listening to a police scanner, waiting for a crime to happen. The station's decision to adopt a then-novel action news format dictated that hyper-focus on crime. But, as detailed in a new report from the Philadelphia Inquirer, it also dictated that the scanner being monitored was in Kensington, a multiracial working-class neighborhood struggling with poverty and its attendant ills, and not someplace else. Lights, Camera, Crime is an early installment of the Inquirer's A More Perfect Union project, aimed at examining the roots and branches of racism in U.S. institutions.